For our sermon today, we're once again looking in Genesis chapter 1. I told you sometime back that we're turning the page from my science talks and looking more at some historical evidences, but as I was looking at this, I got to give you one more little jolt of science. So this is another bit of science. And it kind of rounds out what we've been talking about the past few months for a broad-based argument from design. That is to say, by looking at the features of our universe, we can tell that our universe, we ourselves, that's the topic today, are products of God's intelligent design. I like to start off with testimonies, and today I want to start off with a testimony of a guy named Alfred Russel Wallace. Alfred Russel Wallace is someone that you quite probably haven't heard of, but you have heard of his very famous scientific partner, Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace both kind of came to their scientific idea for the theory of evolution at the same time. In fact, they co-authored a number of the early papers on it. But Darwin is the only one whose name has come down to us as still connected to the theory of evolution. And the reason for that is because his old partner, or partner is probably too strong a word, they collaborated in some sense, but his old collaborator, Alfred Russel Wallace, decided to back off. Because as he thought through the theory of evolution by natural selection, which remember we talked about last week, that's the idea that purely natural means alone could evolve all the forms we see today. There are some Christians who believe that evolution may have happened, but those who do believe strongly that it was God who designed and guided and planned that process. Evolution under the Darwinian theory is just natural forces alone could have made it happen. And Alfred Russel Wallace kept looking at this and he felt like it just can't have happened in that way. And he said for three reasons. He says, we can't explain how life could have come out of non-living chemicals. We've looked at some of the evidence that says that that is practically impossible given the conditions on our Earth. The second thing was he couldn't explain the emergence of consciousness in higher animals, and he couldn't explain the endowment of humanity with a soul. It was the sheer uniqueness of humanity that led one of the designers of the theory of evolution to say, you know what, I don't think this could have happened just on its own. And so what we're going to look at today is some of the evidences about the way God has made us, as in the language of Genesis, the image of God, and hopefully give you some insight into just the way kind of our bodies and our speech and our minds work that maybe we don't often think about, but testify to the incredible handiwork of God. So today we're looking once again in Genesis chapter 1, and our passage begins at verse 26. So this is in the account of Genesis chapter 1, this is the climax of the sixth day of creation. On the sixth day, God has created animal creation, sort of ground-dwelling animal creation. And at the climax of that, he creates humanity. Verse 26. Likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves in the ground. So I want to give you just a quick glimpse of what we mean when we talk about humanity as being made in the image of God. And then we're going to look at some evidences from science that speak to that design. When we say that humanity is made in the image of God, we're not saying that God looks like us in our physical form, right? We believe that God is spirit. He certainly can appear to us in the form of a body. Jesus Christ was incarnated in a real human body. But God is spirit, and so when we're made in the image of God, it's not saying that God has physical hands and physical feet and so on, apart from his incarnation in Jesus. What it's saying is that our spiritual aspects and our mental aspects reflect some of God's own character in his creativity, in his reason, in all those things that make him who he is, that we also display in ways that no other part of animal creation does. Calling us the image of God also speaks to our role. The early church liked to think about the image of God as being a description of who we are as God's royal priesthood. I've got a lot about this in my new book, so if any of this sparks an interest, just let me know and I can get you a copy. But essentially what they're saying is to be made in the image of God means that we are both kings and priests of God's creation. Kings in the sense that God spells out right here. We are creatures who are called to have dominion. Right, to rule over the earth. And priests, in the ancient world, priests were the beings who stood between God and the rest of his creation. It was a, sort of this representative function. And so we humans, the only creatures in all of God's creation who are both spiritual in a way that can relate to God and physical in a way that can relate to the material world. Nothing else is that way, not angels, not other animals. We stand in this unique position of representing God in his creation, representing the material world in the spiritual world, and the spiritual world in the material world. So as 1 Peter says, that we have been designated as God's royal priesthood. And John also says it in Revelation 1 and 5, that we are kings and priests. So that's some of the idea of the image of God. It's a really high view of humanity, of who God has endowed us to be in all the rational, creative, moral ways that he has made us. And if you think about it, there really is nothing else in creation that does that. If we think about our call to have dominion over animal creation, it says rule over the animals and the birds and the fish. There's no other being in God's creation that does what we do, even in simple things that we're all familiar with, like domesticating animals, right? Many of us have pets at home, and we kind of exercise a rulership over these dogs and cats or farm animals that we work with. You don't find anything else in creation doing that. You do find some species that will have kind of made a symbiotic relationship to help each other out, but you don't find, like, you know, a jaguar in the jungle raising a flock of goats and tending them out in the fields. It's something only humans do. And it shows that we exercise this dominion. We stand in a special place in God's world. What I want to give you today is three sets of scientific evidence that there is something wildly different about humanity that speaks to the specialness of our creation by God. Three sets of evidence. One is about our body, one is about kind of our language and our creative and rational abilities, and one is about the working of our minds. So the first one is about our body. You know, we look at our bodies and it may not seem that extraordinary. In fact, a lot of skeptics look at our bodies and say, you know what, it just looks like we're some kind of weird ape that's decided to start wearing clothes. You know, try not to take offense at that, but, you know, we've got these forward-facing, expressive faces. We've got arms with hands on them, and we've got a torso. You know, it doesn't look that different from what an orangutan might look like. One of the classic arguments of Christians, though, is to say, you know, God creates his creatures with a form that fits their function. And a lot of the great apes do have, you know, similar functions in their habitats, and so it's not really a surprise that there would be some similarity of features in that way. But human beings are wildly different in a number of other ways. Humans show what we call specified complexity, and this is a key term in intelligent design. Specified complexity is something that is highly complex, but also very, very improbable. Highly complex, but very, very improbable. And if you find those two things together, that's usually a key indication that something has been designed. And we look at this in anywhere you look in the world around you. One of the classic examples from the history of this debate is if you're walking along the beach and you find a pocket watch and you open it up and all these intricate gears inside. If you've never seen a watch before of any kind, you would still be able to tell somebody made this. This is highly complex, and it's also very improbable from what I know of what the natural world can make. Somebody made this thing. So specified complexity, we see it in some of the cellular machinery we talked about last week with irreducible parts in cellular systems. We also see it in our own bodies. Here's a few ways that humans are kind of strange relative to the rest of creation. So the human brain relative to body size is 8 times larger than any other creature in the world. That doesn't mean we have the biggest brain of all, right? There are whales that have bigger brains than ours. But scientists have found out that intelligence often is a factor of the ratio between brain size and body size. And so it's quite something to say this statistic. If I gave out the statistic and said, well, humans show, you know, double the brain size of any other ratio, brain size to body size, of any other creature, people would look at that and say, wow, double that ratio of any other creature. This is a really smart species. We have 8 times that ratio. Humans, if you graphed a chart of like brain size to body size for creatures, you know, you could have a trend line like this, and you'd have human beings way up here. We are obviously designed for a much more intellectual, mental life than any other creature in the world. The human life cycle, scholars are now finding that the human life cycle appears to be designed to pass on cultural systems in a way that's true of no other species. I'll give you a little bit more detail on that point in my Tuesday video. But in short, they're kind of researching life cycle and developmental stages. And humans are weird in a lot of ways for this. Not only do we have bigger brains, but we come out of the womb much, much earlier than other animals do at similar stages of development. We have much longer lifespans than a lot of similar animals. And all of these factors allow us to have generations that are able to pass on and form culture for human babies in a way that no other species ever gets to do. The human speech system is also extraordinary. And I'll deal with this more on Tuesday as well. But the human speech system, the way we are able to create language with our mouths, is another instance of what scholars are calling specified complexity. It's highly complex and also highly improbable. But the one that I want to spend the most time letting you know about today for our uniqueness is actually about language. It's something we don't think about much at all, but this is one of my favorite areas of academic study. I actually started as an undergraduate in linguistics, the study of languages. At the time, I thought I might be being called as a Bible translator, and so you study linguistics. We don't tend to think about language much because, you know, we know a language and we're just able to speak it. It's second nature to us. It just comes on out. In point of fact, languages are wildly complex. And of course, you know this if you've ever tried at a late stage in life to study another language. It is really hard to do. Languages are very complex and they're filled with rules that native speakers like us for English, we don't even realize all the rules we're using. They're all back there somewhere in our brains and we couldn't even tell you about them. But we know them and we use them. Here's what's interesting about language. One is that it does not fit what you would predict from an evolutionary model. And two is that they can't explain how it began at all. So, number one, if you were thinking as a naturalistic evolutionist, all these things develop without any help from God, just pure natural systems, you would expect for language to develop from simple to complex. You would expect, you know, some caveman sitting in his cave, you know, grunting to his wife to try to communicate. Eventually they'll come up with a simple word for rock or a simple word for bird or something like this. And then it gradually becomes more complex over time. What you actually find in the study of languages is that this is not the case at all. In fact, it's backwards. Naturalistic evolutionists suspected that when they went out on voyages of exploration and talked to primitive tribes out in the jungle who they thought were more like Stone Age level of living, they thought that they what they would find was very simple, basic languages, lower intellectual capacities, things of that nature. That is the opposite of what they found. What they find is that so-called primitive languages are wildly more complicated than any other languages that there are. In fact, they're so complicated that if you come into a language without growing up in it, you are never going to get to be a fluent native speaker of these isolated primitive languages because they are so complex. You get a taste of this, actually, if you've ever studied an ancient language. Maybe some of you studied Latin in high school back in the day, and you had just tables and tables of noun case endings and of declensions and of conjugations for verbs. And after you'd memorize all of those, you find out that all the most common verbs are irregular and they don't follow any rules at all. You just have to memorize them. It is wildly complicated. In fact, there's a cool historical story about this. In World War II, they used the Navajo language as a way to communicate in code in the Pacific Theater because it was just so hard for anyone outside to understand. So it wasn't even necessarily code in the way we usually think of it. They just got a bunch of Navajo guys to talk Navajo to each other, and nobody could crack it. What they found is that amongst the most primitive peoples, and if anyone's listening to this on audio, I'm using quotations. I don't believe there are any primitive societies. They found that they are very complex, not only in language, but in intellectual capacity. So languages upset that naturalistic expectation. But as linguists have worked on languages, they've been able to kind of work back, see what languages are related, construct language families, and kind of go back to recreate what would the original languages in these families, English is part of the Indo-European language family, what would the original Indo-European language have been like? And turns out to have been wildly complicated. English actually is very simple. A lot of people, it gets this reputation of being a hard language to learn. It's only hard because it has a lot of words. We borrow words from everybody, right? So we have way more words than we need. And we don't spell things with anything close to a system that makes sense. But in terms of its grammar, it's actually a fairly simple language. One linguist called English a simple language absurdly spelled. But other languages, especially languages with ancient roots, tend to be very complicated. So they've traced these language families back, but they cannot predict how language started, because it doesn't seem to be any simpler root from which it sprang. Noam Chomsky, before he became a political theorist, was one of the most widely known linguists in the world, and he decided that, you know what, we have no idea for this. The best idea he could come up with was that language came to somebody way back there, and that somebody just passed it on. But from what they see, it couldn't have developed in the way that evolutionists usually imagined it. So this is an instance in which you see this specified complexity of human language. You see this too in other parts of early human history as archaeologists dig up these ancient sites. What paleoanthropologists are finding as they research these ancient sites, you know, all around the world where early humans have been populated, what they find is that there is something radically different when humans, members of our Homo genus, show up on the scene. something wildly different than anything that's gone before. It's not like us. You would expect from naturalistic evolution to see a slow, gradual ascent of kind of people starting to gain new intellectual capacities and new cultural systems along the way. That's not what they find. What they find is what they refer to as the human Big Bang, and that is, boom, humans show up in these sites, and all of a sudden you have art and music and spirituality. You have evidences for cave paintings, and you have flutes made out of elk antlers, and you have burial rituals. It's such a striking difference that they can't explain it. Ian Tattersall, a paleoanthropologist, says that when modern humans show up in the archaeological record, they represent something entirely new, and that their emergence is the most baffling question in all of biology. Humans just come and they are already what we expect humans to be. They are thinking, they are creative, they are reflecting the image of God. That's not what naturalistic evolution would have predicted, but it is exactly what the gospel, what the Bible would have predicted of humans. I should say too that when we're thinking of these so-called primitive societies, the historical legacy of Darwinian evolution was particularly cruel, because they expected to find lower developed, lower evolved sets of humans around the world in these other areas, in the Australian outback, in the jungles, and so on. And so early in the 20th century, they were capturing people and putting them in zoos, putting them on display as lesser evolved examples of humans. And what we've actually found is that that is about as far from the case as possible. There are more than 7 billion humans in the world, and yet we are more closely related to each other than the few hundred gorillas that exist in the world today. There's only a 0.3 variance in the DNA of everybody in the world, humans, and there's more than double that in gorilla populations, even though they have much smaller numbers of individuals. So that is to say, there are no groups on Earth that are less evolved than others. The data proves very clearly we are all humans. And guess what? That's exactly what Scripture predicts. All humans are humans. Every human in the world is made in the image of God and endowed with the grandeur of that office. The third and final evidence has to do with the mind. Because one of the other things, this is kind of the dirty little secret of naturalistic philosophy. If you think your body came together just by purely natural physical forces, there is no way to get past the conclusion that you do not have free will. You don't. It might seem like you have free will, but you don't. If you are just a product of chemical interactions, and if everything that you are thinking and feeling is still a product of chemical interactions, neurons in your brain, you actually do not have free will. And there is no philosophical way to get around that. You simply are a slave to whatever your neurons are doing. You might think, you might feel like you're in control, but you're actually not. This gray hunk of meat that acts like a computer in your brain, it's going to do what it's going to do, unless there is something else going on. Materialism has not been able to explain the existence of free will. And our experience as humans, actually, not only our intuition, but our experience, seems to push back against that. Like, we know that humans are able to have epiphanies and transformations to radically alter their behavior and their way of life from one stage to another. If you are only the product of foreseeable chemical interactions in your brain, that kind of transformation should not be possible. But it is. It is. In fact, that view of the material function of the brain can't even explain consciousness. They can't explain how it works, this thing we call consciousness. Scientists are working now to develop AI, artificial intelligence, but philosophically, we're still not even close. It's not even a matter of being close. There is just no way to understand how you could even get a computer to wake up and become self-aware. Even the most advanced computers, you can program them to do certain things. You can program them to learn and adapt. But can you program it to awaken? The answer is scientists have no answer for that. We have no clue how consciousness happens. In our brains, in animal brains, it just doesn't seem explainable by material phenomenon alone. And so what you'll have is you actually have scientific theorists in these fields, skeptics who are not Christians, who are saying that what we now believe is that there's some kind of spirit or mind that is just endowed through all matter. It's a view called panpsychism, that spirit is kind of interwoven through everything. It sounds like kind of a New Agey idea, and it sort of is. But they're going to that because they can't explain the spiritual features of humanity, how this could have possibly come about by itself. The only way they can explain it is to say that all of the universe must have some latent capacity for mind. The other follow-up to this in thinking about the brain, if the brain is just a product of long, unguided natural selection, random chemical interactions that developed the way ours did, one of the other problems is that there's no reliable way to think that our brains are trustworthy. They're a product of evolutionary pressures over millions of years, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're right. They're just the product of whatever got us here. And so Darwin actually thought this was one of the major problems with his theory. He writes, "With me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind?" That's Darwin who writes that. He's saying, look, if my theory is true, then we just have sort of evolved monkey brains. And what reason do we have for believing them? And so this is a good tactic to kind of hit back at materialists, natural materialists, who say these things, to say, well, what driving reason do I have for accepting the things that you're saying? Your thoughts are just the product of random chemical interactions, and they might not be right. That is an avenue that's hard for them to get by. What I want to do here, just in closing, is to remind us of what we've seen in this broad argument for design over the past few months. We've seen that the evidence always leaves you with a choice. The choice is either this universe and its features came together somewhere else, in some other way, in some other place or situation that we can't explain or observe, or someone made it, right? And so skeptics are always reaching for this position. They're saying, well, we can't explain the evidence as we see it now, so it must have happened somewhere else. We can't explain why our universe is fine-tuned, so it must be one of a billion, billion, billion other universes, and we just won the lottery. You can never actually check for those other universes because they're other universes. It's not observable, it's not provable. When they're faced with the impossibility of life emerging from non-living elements, they say, well, it can't have happened here, so it must have happened somewhere else. That's a theory of panspermia. It happened somewhere else in the galaxy, maybe where conditions allowed it. We can't test for that, we can't observe for that, but it must have happened there because we know it couldn't have happened here, and then it came here. Skeptics do the same thing when it comes to the fossil record. We talked last week about gaps in the fossil record and the Cambrian explosion, where all these creatures appear all at once. They come up with theories that essentially say, well, it just happens in a place that we can't see it. So they would say naturalistic evolution happens by punctuated equilibrium, which means that instead of long, slow changes over time that you would be able to see in transitional forms, it just kind of pops up every now and then when conditions arise. Things can change really fast. And that's why you see these new animals popping up so suddenly in the fossil record. But again, They're saying it happened somewhere else, somewhere we can't observe, but it must happen that way. And the ones we talked about today, they're saying a human Big Bang. We can't explain where human mind, culture, art, religion, language come from. It must have just come to someone back there and then he passed it on. Panpsychism. We can't explain how these computers of meat create consciousness. So it must be that there is some mystical mind interwoven with all creation that we can't see, hear, feel, or test for in any way. But it has to be there because that's where the evidence points. You see, every single time the evidence is setting up this set of options. Either things are coming together randomly by natural causation alone in some other place that we can't test for, or they're being designed. It seems to me that the far simpler and more logical explanation is that they're designed. That all these things show the fingerprints of a good God who knows what he's doing and who loves his creation. So today, hopefully, you get a little sense of the staggering uniqueness of humanity, of who you are. Psalm 139 says that we are knit together in our mother's wombs. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. I think that is true of every single one of us. We're made in the image of God. We are endowed with the splendor of his reign and his character. And the manner of our making testifies to the reality of our Maker. Would you bow your heads in prayer with me? Lord God, we are thankful that you paint the evidence for your existence so clearly around us. And we do pray, Lord, that in our age where these evidences are being so easily seen and so readily thought about and discussed, we pray that you would continue to bring more and more and more of these researchers to this awareness that the simplest and the best answer is the one that's always been there. That you have made this universe for your glory and that you have called us to be a part of it. Help us, Lord, this week to inhabit our identities as your image, as your kings and priests, and help us to exercise the dominion and to reflect your character as you have granted us to do. And may it be a blessing to all those we meet. In Jesus' name, amen.